This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a different focus today as we try to get the word out about a chance for Vietnam veterans to receive the welcome home they never experienced a half century ago. That event will take place before a AAA baseball game in Fresno, California on April 28th. Any Vietnam veteran can get two free tickets, and that also applies for widows of Vietnam vets who have left us as well. I know there were times when Smokey Rickard wondered if he was going to leave his wife in that tragic position as he flew 288 combat missions in the skies over Vietnam. But why don't we start growing up in Central California, Smokey? Did you always know you were going to be a pilot?
You know, as a kid, you have a lot of aspirations, and one of those was being a pilot. But, you know, being a country boy and living on a ranch, all I ever thought that, I would grow up on the ranch and possibly go into agriculture, which is a great, great profession. And so I thought I was going to do that. I did play ball in high school, and then fortunately, I was able to play ball in college. And I was doing that, I thought, boy, what'd be great. I enjoy coaching, helping younger kids as I was growing up. So I thought, well, maybe one of these days I would be a coach. But no, when you're growing up, you never experienced or even thought that. And even though we were living close to Castle and Navy Lamar, no, there was never an idea that I would ever be a pilot.
Did you think you were going to be a pro football player?
Growing up as a kid, you always hoped that you had that quality. But as I got older, I didn't think I would ever be a pro football. I was looking for baseball. But at the same time, baseball and football was my two areas that I really loved. But as I was going forward, then with the draft coming in, it kind of stopped everything, you know, later on. So at that particular time, life ceased, kind of like stopped back in the 69 type frame when it says you're going to have to go in the military. It's kind of like, whoa, wait a minute. I hadn't planned on that.
Well, let's talk about that because, I spent a lot of time talking to World War II veterans. For all of them, it was December 7th, 1941, it changed the world. And of course, they had a draft even before that, and guys knew they were going to be a part of this. So you're coming up in the 60s, you play college football for the Fresno State Bulldogs, and I'm sure you're planning your life out, right? You're saying, I'm going to do this and this and this and this. When did you realize that, hey, you could be snatched up and have to go halfway across the world to serve your country?
When you turn 18, you wind up going down and you sign up for the draft at that particular time, selective service. And then soon after that, you went in and you wound up taking a selective service, you know, physical and testing and stuff like that. And I think that became a kind of an eye-opener and stuff like that. And I had talked to my granddad who raised me, and my grandmother granddad, and he was World War I veteran. We talked. And then my dad was World War II, and we talked about that, and of course with my uncle as well. And then, you know, I went ahead and I got married. We had a child. I was going to school and playing ball. And then all of a sudden, it says, I received a letter saying, welcome, you're in the United States. You've been drafted by the United States Army. That was really a big eye-opener at that particular time. So I went down to Madeira. That was my draft. And I said, you know, what are you doing? I'm in college. I'm married. I have a child. And they said, Snorri Smoke, you know, we're to the point now, our requirements are start taking people like you. You know, married ones and stuff like that. So I decided I'd go down, and after thinking all different ways and what people were telling me, I went down and took the test for the Air Force and the Navy, Marines. And 5 o'clock the day I was supposed to left, the next day before Army, I got a call from Air Force says, hey, you know, we have an opportunity for you. Would you accept going to Officers Candidates Training School? And then if you pass that, go on to be a pilot. And I said, a pilot? You know, I couldn't believe it. I said, absolutely, because Army had already told me that they were going to take me and put me in as a warrant officer, and I was going to be put in helicopters, and I was going to be sent to Vietnam. That's basically what they said. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, if I'm going to be a pilot, I might as well try to be a fixed-wing pilot and stuff like that. So I accepted that offer to the Air Force. So they gave me a delayed enlistment to finish my schooling. And so, I mean, that's when it kind of like everything turned away from being sports. And I knew what my life was going to be for the next few years. So I got my schooling done, and I graduated like in December, and I was in the military February.
Did you play football that fall?
No, I didn't have. I didn't have the opportunity. I was on the field. And then they said, hey, and I told the coach, I said, Coach, I'm sorry. I want to play, but I know what's going to happen if I don't get my schooling out of the way. So I went, got my education out of the way, and went on. So my heart was there. My heart was there all the time. But I had to think about my family, and had to think about going into military and what was best for that. So that's when you asked me that, it was like 69 when it says everything changed, my whole life changed. So.
Well, and that's what I wanted to get at, because you think about it today, and there are people listening right now who lived through this time, and there are those who didn't, and you think about college football today. And I mean, it's a religion for some people. It's something
amen.
You would never consider giving up this opportunity. But you were faced with that decision, and I'm sure you weren't the only guy on the team who was probably having similar concerns and thoughts. Do you remember how unsettling that time period felt?
Yeah, not only for myself, but for my wife and family. I mean, it was like, what do you mean you're going in the military? What do you mean that you're going to leave us? What do you mean that you know that you're going to wind up going over across the seas to possibly to war? It was like, what? I mean, my wife, I was 21, she was 18. And then when we had the baby, she was coming up on 20, and I was, about 22, 23 years old. And in matter of fact, when I proposed to her, I said, hey, would you like to be a coach's wife? And she looked at me and says, who's going to be the coach? So, I mean, yeah, I mean, from then on, it, like I said, everything just changed.
You know, it strikes me, too, one of the reasons that this has been a touchy subject for so many decades is that there was such disagreement about whether or not Americans should be over there, what they were over there for, what you were trying to accomplish. Did you have a sense of that at the time, what you were going there for and what the mission or the overall task was?
Well, I think the main thing is you to be able to keep some type of sense to yourself and civility in you and thinking about logic. You had to think that, first of all, you're doing what the government is telling you. You're in the military right now. The military is saying, hey, you're going to be doing this, and it's for the good of the government, the good of the country. And so you had to think like that, or if not, you would go crazy. If you had a disparity between what you're believing in and what you're doing, you would wind up driving yourself crazy. So you had to believe in what you were being told and what your commanding officers were telling you to do and going forward and what your country says. So, yeah, I think, you know, you said yes. You believed in it when you went over there, and you wound up doing the very, very best you can. Knowing that it was a way, it was, again, it was another eye-opener when you wake up one day and kind of like, you know, United States, and then you maybe go to a foreign country, and especially Vietnam, and all of a sudden you wake up and you get off that airplane and you walk out there and things are so much different. I mean, buses are now look like, you know, with sandbags on the floor and barbed wire and wire on the side of the buses and over, you know, behind you and in the distance, you can hear artillery going off and stuff like that. You can catch yourself thinking, oh, that's just a training environment. But all of a sudden, how soon you realize it's not a training environment. And then you wake up and you say, where in the heck am I at? And how did I get here? Mm-hmm. So I think it's really a big wake-up call between just like switching on a TV and off and on. It was really big.
Well, let's talk about the missions you were flying over there. What kind of aircraft were you flying, and what was the purpose of those missions?
I was a forward air controller. I was a FAC. And the main idea of the FAC was twofold, controlling all airstrikes and air power going into South Vietnam. We would go out there and we look for strike capabilities, also for, let's say, if you want to call us, use the bad guys, and if they were coming into South Vietnam to try to stop them, to interdict them, just looking for targets like that. And we were told the rules of engagement. We were told what you would be looking for, what we could and could not do, and you had to follow those rules. And so we were looking for anything to be able to help deter the advancement from the Viet Cong and also the NVA, North Vietnamese Northern Army. I was flying the OV-10, OV-10 Bronco. It was a twin turboprop. We carried our own ordnance. We carried rockets, and we also carried four 7.62 miniguns, two on each side. And so if we could destroy or, let's say, deter the targets, we would. If not, then we would call in the fighters and stuff like that. And then I also had an exchange program with the Navy. I had a chance to fly off the USS Kitty Hawk, and I flew 15 missions in the F-4. So we had an exchange program. Then they came and flew with me in Da Nang and Pleiku and other places like that.
And on that OV-10, what's your crew?
One person, unless you were instructing or trying to welcome another one of your pilots, kind of like that, getting them trained into the area and stuff like that, or if you were going to do artillery adjustment with the Marines or with our naval gunfires, we'd carry a Marine in the back or a naval controller in the back, which was called a Wolfman. And in between us putting in fighters, and they were putting in naval artillery, and then when we had the fighters come on, they would stop, and we'd put in fighters, and we'd keep going back. So it was kind of like touch-and-go type things.
So in a lot of ways, you're on your own.
We are. We were.
And you're kind of the front line in the air, right? Scouting it out?
Correct. That's exactly right. We were the ones out there in the forward of everybody trying to look and check and try to find targets and be able to understand where everybody was at. So we knew that land, lay of the land, like the back of your hand. We got to the point that, I can say for myself, I became to start like playing sports. You start thinking like them, acting like them, and start thinking like them, and I started getting to the point that I became very, very good at identifying camouflage. And so from a distance, I could pick up underwater bridges or where they had their POL storage location. So, yeah, I mean, you started getting to know the land. If it changed one thing or another, you got to know. So it was interesting.
And what were the dangers you faced? I know that's a lot of missions that I'm kind of muddling together there, but in general, what were the kind of potential dangers you faced?
Well, I think, of course, several of them there. You could wind up artillery, of course, ground artillery, missiles. Those were your biggest ones. You get into areas that you maybe not see the missiles. Of course, a lot of them were heat-seeking, so you didn't see until after, corkscrew. Unless you happen to be seeing the flash or whatever the case may be. Of course, the AAA, the artillery. What scared me the worst was the fast-forward ordnance, rapid firing, like the 51 cals, 23s. But you'd still get some big ones. A lot of times they would have the AAA that would get you high, and then they'd drive you down low. And then once they got you down low, then they would try to hit you with the 23s and 51s, the smaller rapid-firing ones. And then here again, if you got down low enough, of course, too, in that area, then you're also looking for the heat-seeking Strela handheld devices that could knock you down and go into your engines, stuff like that, or any portion that would be able to seek the heat from your aircraft. It could knock you down, it could destroy you, or hit you just right, or what'll happen, you would wind up maybe with one engine less and trying to get home. So there was a lot of, the opportunity like that. Same way for your fighters when you're bringing them in. Same thing was happening to them. They had the same concerns about being shot down that way.
Well, and as I hear you describe that, it occurs to me that you have such a strong grasp and inventory of those hazards because you probably saw each one of those hazards claim an airplane.
Yes.
Whether it was yours or somebody else's.
Yes.
And you're taken to the skies on every one of these missions knowing that you've got a wife and a child back home. How hard was that to do, to take off from one of those missions with that knowledge in the back of your head?
You really had to forget it. You really had to forget and keep your mind on what was happening because after you got down and you could thank God that you made it home okay, you wind up having to forget that you have a wife and child because it would just drive you crazy. And you got homesick. You really, really got homesick. So during that particular time, if you got your mind somewhere else and not into the game, so to speak, you could wind up, they were after you. I mean, that's what they were doing. They were after you because the forward air controllers, the Coveys, the Facs, the Rustics, the Sundogs, so there was a variety of airplanes that were doing the same thing. Some put into a lower threat area, some, the OV-10 was in the high threat area. If you wasn't watching what you're doing, they were after you, and they would be trying to get you down. As a matter of fact, what was also ironic, they had bounties. They knew our call signs and stuff like that and got to know us just like we got to know some of them on the phone. But when they would actually pop up and start talking. But they knew us, and there was some, intel that was taken that they had big, high rewards on if you could get certain FAC or whatever down. They got paid reward. Well, whatever the reward was, I don't know.
What was your call sign?
I was Covey 566, and then we changed from 566, depending on where you flew out of. I was 566, Covey 266, and then we just dropped it later on, just was 66.
But you would have the enemy find your frequency and actually speak English
absolutely.
To you?
Oh, absolutely. We would have a conversation, if you want to call it that. And, of course, we had homing devices. Some of us had homing devices in our aircraft that home in on there. As long as we keep them keying the microphone, we could home in and know exactly where they're at and see what we could do about ending their transmission.
So what would those conversations be like? I mean, it's like trash talk on the football field or baseball diamond?
It was actually trash talk. Oh, yeah. You know, sometimes they really got personal because they got to know that you knew so-and-so. And there was a couple of times they would come up and they'd say, hey, Cubby 6'6 or 5'6'6, we're going to shoot you down like we did your roommate or like we did you know, your other Covey or whatever the case may be. And, you know, it tried to get, you know, get your name, you know, your mind out of the game to get you to do something stupid and start not think about what's really going and get you kind of like the black widow in the web, so to speak. And there was transmissions constantly either trying to be jammed or interfered with or come on to. So even Army, Navy, and Air Force and Marines, somewhere along the line, they had a chance to talk to a few of those same ones too.
So when you say that the enemy's trash talk included things like, we're going to do you like we did your roommate, I mean, that tells me that there were things that happened to other pilots that you knew very well. What are some of those things that you had to endure happening to the guys you had been serving with?
There was 13 individuals from my outfit while I was over there that didn't come back. Matter of fact, five of them were roommates of mine, and then one of them came back as a POW. You know, you have to trick yourself, you know, into thinking that, okay, you know, Art's not here, or Bruce is not here, or Steve's not here, because he went somewhere else, or he went home. Because you did grieve. You did grieve for a while. You did, you know, you went to a place by yourself and shed a tear, you know. But it was really, really hard, and trying to get over it, you know, it was very challenging, you know, to say the least. And some of them even came back, you know, their names or about them came back, you know, 40 years later, you know, when you see their family, and you didn't realize that was going to happen. No, there was several of them, and a lot of them I felt I have, you know, I still have problems with because I became the chief scheduler. And the ones that went down, I scheduled them for that mission. And so what really makes you, you know, what would happen if I hadn't put them on that particular mission? What happened if I'd have put them on another mission? Or maybe if I'd have taken a mission, that mission myself. And, you know, you start talking to yourself, you know, you start second guessing yourself. But after a while, you just have to say, you know, there's nothing you can do. You just got to go on, or it would drive you crazy.
It is a harsh reality that those of us who've never served in those conditions have a hard time truly grasping. But you're helping us out today. Time for our last break, but when we come back, a mission that left Smokey Rickard with the Distinguished Flying Cross, the Purple Heart, and a prestigious medal from the Vietnamese government as well. You might have a hard time believing he survived it. Pull up all that information about the Welcome Home Vietnam Veterans event coming up at the end of April. Any Vietnam vet is encouraged to attend. Find that at hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this.